Taking a look next at science, science research, science education, our guest Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry and William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA. He's Director of the Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy. And if that isn't enough, he's also added the title of President-elect of the American Chemical Society, which I believe is the largest professional society in the world. Wow. Congratulations, I think, Bassam.
Well, thank you, of course, Larry. I'm happy to be here. Happy New Year to you. Here's a stack of your favorite periodic table cups.
Yes,
thank
you.
Which I know you and your guests enjoy. And here's a little something for you and for Emily and for Renee and everyone else in the station here. Maybe you can describe what that is.
Well, let's see. It looks, it's a little round cylinder, probably about an inch or three quarters of an inch high.
And what's striking about it?
Well, it's got a light inside and it's turning colors. It's turning blue and yellow. Was it red too? It's sort of a violet color. Oh, then it's red.
Yeah, it's a light-emitting diode. It's an LED. Actually, there are three of them in there.
Oh.
And so I wonder,
oh,
you know,
you
share this around with your family and with others and see what kind of conversations it generates. So Happy New Year, Larry.
Well, thank you very much. And I love the cup with a periodic table of elements on it. It's a water cup, and we give this away, and I can't tell you how many people who are guests on my shows say, I'm going to take the cup with me, and they take it home with them.
I'm glad to hear that.
It's wonderful. Well, what are you going to be doing with the American Chemical Society?
Larry, let me first say I'm truly honored and humbled to be elected president of the largest scientific organization in the world. I am the third UW-Madison faculty member to receive this honor. Farrington Daniels served as president in 1953. In fact, our chemistry building, one of our three chemistry buildings, is named after him. And then Charles Casey served as president of the ACS in 2004. So this is really a great tribute to UW-Madison and its faculty. And the American Chemical Society has over 160,000 members. It is chartered by the U.S. Congress. And it publishes scientific journals, about 38 of them to be exact, not about to be exact. And it supports 189 local sections, including the Wisconsin section, of which I'm a member. There are 34 scientific specialty divisions, you know, agriculture and medicinal chemistry and chemical education, physical chemistry, and so on. It's a nonprofit group, and it's at the forefront of the evolving world chemical enterprise. You know, Larry, we live in a chemical world. Everything around us is made of chemicals.
Right.
The food that we eat is a mixture of chemicals. The air that we breathe is usually a mixture of good chemicals. And then our bodies are made of chemicals.
Yeah.
What's inside our bodies is nothing but a series of biochemical reactions. The medicine that we take is made of chemicals. The drugs that some people very stupidly experiment with are chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of our tasks in the American Chemical Society is to develop a sense of appreciation of the role of chemistry in society and to learn about chemicals, their properties, their safe handling, their hazards, potential hazards, and their benefits. So we get to enjoy the beautiful chemical world that we live in. And the American Chemical Society, as I said, publishes 38 scientific journals. They are the most prestigious, among the most prestigious journals in the world. And through that means of communication, we are scientists, chemists, chemical engineers, industrial chemists, pharmaceutical chemists are able to communicate with each other. And the society was established, as I say, chartered by the U.S. Congress in 1876. So it's been around for a while. And I'm very, very proud to have this opportunity to serve as president-elect this year, president next year. and immediate past president the year after on the board of directors. So you'll be hearing from me more about chemistry. You already hear enough, but you're going to hear more than that in the upcoming visits I have with you.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, coincidentally, 2011 is the United Nations designated International Year of Chemistry. What's the goal of this year in chemistry?
The International Year of Chemistry. By the way, I have a pin here for you, Larry.
Wow.
You see, just like the pin I have on my lapel.
Oh, I see it.
It is. What does it say on it? It says
2011.
The International Year of Chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
It's a worldwide celebration of the achievements of chemistry and its contributions to the well-being of humankind. The theme of the International Year of Chemistry is Chemistry, Our Life, Our Future. That's the theme. Chemistry, Our Life, Our Future. We offer during this year a wide range of interactive, entertaining, and educational activities for all ages. It is intended to reach, these activities are intended to reach across the globe with opportunities for public participation at local, regional, and national levels, and in Wisconsin and everywhere around the country, in fact, around the world, there will be a series of activities engaging the public so that we all learn more about chemistry, more about chemicals, and how to handle them safely, how to understand the impact of chemistry on the progress of society, how to really begin to appreciate the important responsibility that we all have in the safe handling of chemicals, the impact of chemicals have on our daily lives and on the environment. So climate change, for example, mm-hmm. Understanding what the greenhouse gas effect is and how we can control contributions that people make to carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But we also have a lot of celebrations, you know, very similar to the Sciences Fund presentations mm-hmm. that my group and I have been doing for many years. And you know, so you'll see chemists all over the world and participating in such activities. I have a report in front of me here that says that in China they've already done some activities in Korea. And the big launch for the United States is on February 1st at the Chemical Heritage Foundation in Philadelphia. So I urge everyone in the listening audience to think chemistry, think about chemicals, think about what you had for breakfast. Think about what it is that you are doing when you're breathing. A whole bunch of chemical transformations are taking place inside the body, and the discipline of chemistry is to help us understand how these different transformations happen, and to remember also to be inquisitive and to ask questions at home, in school, in the shopping mm-hmm. mall. Look around you. Look and enjoy the beautiful chemicals that we all have around us here and ask questions about them. And if you have some direct questions to me,
You
can do it right now.
Here's the number to call, by the way. It's 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. We had a caller call in, couldn't hang online, but wondered if you could talk about the legacy. You mentioned Farrington Daniels, and if you could talk about the legacy of Farrington Daniels, and also our new science center that's on the UW-Madison campus.
Farrington Daniels was a chemistry professor for a long time at UW-Madison. In fact, he was chair of the chemistry department. He was a physical chemist. He did a lot of research, and he was a pioneer in solar energy. He was a pioneer looking in how we can develop panels to capture energy from the sun and transform it into our homes. And he did this, you know, over 50 years ago or so. Another part of his legacy is that he trained a lot of PhD students to pursue careers in chemistry. He was very successful about that. He died in 1972, 2 years after I joined the faculty here. UW-Madison Chemistry Department has a great deal of rich heritage. J. Howard Matthews was another great chemist, and one of our buildings is named after him. And, of course, Irving Shane, our former chancellor and We have our third building named after him. So the one thing I want to also add, Larry, in this connection, that this happens to be the 100th anniversary of the Nobel Prize awarded to Madame Curie. And so it's an opportunity, as part of the International Year of Chemistry, to celebrate the contributions of women to science. And mm-hmm. this is one important theme of my presidential year next year. That is that not only to celebrate what women have done in science, but to also encourage and nurture young people, especially women, to pursue careers in science and to pursue careers in teaching science and careers in public service that relate to science. I think this is very, very important. So the centennial anniversary of Madame Curie's Nobel Prize is being celebrated this year as well.
Oh, that's great. Well, we have other callers with questions for you. Jay and Stevens Point up next. Jay, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. Hi, Bassam.
Hi, Jay.
Congratulations on your new appointment.
Thank you.
I know you like to talk about the fun parts of science a lot, and I've got a couple questions about the negative side, the downside. I was hit by a fireworks over New Year's, and I believe I suffered phosphorus poisoning through the skin. It kind of tried to blow up through my soft tissue. And it's been a real hassle raising questions and asking questions about the chemistry with the doctors. I don't know, the pharmacological industry is, you know, so protective. They wouldn't even let me look at the chemistry of the drugs they were trying to give me for it, which I think really caused a negative reaction, given that I was suffering from a chemical poisoning, still am. And not a infection.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're wondering if Bassam could talk a little bit about the properties then of.
Well, I'm just, you know, it's difficult out here in the real world to interact with professionals in
All right.
So Jay, I'm really sorry to hear about this accident. I don't know how it happened, and we all have to be very, very careful in handling all kinds of chemicals, especially fireworks. On Larry's show, we have talked many times before, especially around the 4th of July, about the safety aspects of fireworks and the joy that comes actually from watching fireworks. So I'm truly sorry that this has happened to you. My advice, of course, you probably heard this before, is to pursue the best medical attention you can get. And as far as learning about what's in the medication and so on, these are all pieces of information that are available. If you know the name of the medicine, you know, then it's easy to find out what's in it and so on.
I guess my point is the doctors don't like to be questioned. And the other situation that's come up recently is a severe migraine reaction, which I think is due to a chemical in the food supply, monoandiglycerides. It's an ester, degrades differently under acidic and alkaline conditions, and I think it creates the migraine condition of pressure and heat in the brain because it's trying to, the oxygens from the water are being deprotonated, and it causes O2 bubbles inside sticky glyceride packages.
I have a great deal of sympathy for people who suffer from migraines. I have members of my family who suffer from that. And I just want to say again, Jay, how important it is for you to patiently but firmly pursue getting information about your medical condition and about the medication that you are receiving. It's important in science that we communicate not only with fellow scientists, but we communicate with the general public about this. And of course, you know, this is a personal thing that is subject to privacy issues between you and your medical doctor and other people. So I really appreciate your calling and bringing this up, but once again, I regret that this has happened, and I wish you very speedy recovery.
If a person was, and this might be generally applied to others, if you're interested in knowing more about a particular drug, the chemical properties of it. Where's the best place to go to find that? You know, you can go online, I would guess, and find quite a bit of information.
There are lots of places that exactly. You have to be careful about, you know, the internet.
Where you go.
The internet is a very powerful tool, and it gives us a lot of information. But we have to be careful in selecting reliable information from the internet. PDR, you know, in the medical profession, there are the physician's desk reference book, but I still think that, you know, what Jay is talking about has to do with the interaction with the bedside mannerism, interaction between him and his people caring for him medically, and you know, I think it's important for everyone to be able to ask these questions and get answers to them.
Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison professor, our guest today as we talk science research and education. I'm Larry Mueller. Rachel Owens, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take some more calls. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 as we talk science education, and research today with Bassam Shakashiri. Greg in Menominee up next. Greg, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Doctor and Larry. My question deals with, are there a lot of discovery of new elements and chemicals, and does the periodic table need to be updated at, you know, every time?
Yes, yes, Greg. There is extensive research that's carried out not only in this country but elsewhere around the world, especially in Europe, trying to synthesize new elements. The great American scientist Glenn Seaborg, who, by the way, Larry, is also was a former president of the American Chemical Society, he discovered many elements, and in fact, one of them is named after him, Seaborgium. But he proposed a theory that says that there are more stable elements that have not been discovered yet, and so the periodic table is to be extended, but the discoveries are now dealing with elements that have very short half-lives. They don't exist for a long period of time. They're not very stable. They disintegrate. They're radioactive. Some of them have been synthesized, and only four or five atoms have been identified, and they're gone instantaneously. But Seaborg's prediction is that beyond this region where these discoveries are being made now, there will be heavier elements with larger atomic numbers, and he predicts that they will be stable. So, yes, Greg, there are many, many activities and research that deals with the periodic table. And it's really, the periodic table is a very well-organized collection of not only the symbols and some atomic numbers and atomic weights of the elements, but it really it's really a very useful tool for chemists and for scientists, because the elements are organized according to their properties and how they relate to each other and stability and so on. And that's why I think it's very important in this International Year of Chemistry to learn more about the periodic table. And its history is fascinating to begin with. But new discoveries are being made as we speak.
Mm. Interesting. Thanks, Greg, for calling. John in Dunn, we go to you now. Hi, John.
Hey, good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
I got a question for the doctor. I have this happened to us, and I'm curious. My wife was cooking some spinach, and she was stirring it with a silver spoon, either silver or silver plated, I don't know which. And that spoon turned all kinds of colors. It turned purple. It turned gold. And I'm just wondering.
Wondering what?
Was you think the spoon was flawed? Was there something in spinach that could color silver that way? We're just worried about what we've got. Should I throw that spoon away or what?
Well, John, the kitchen is one of the most interesting chemistry laboratories that we have.
It sure is.
And that's all you're doing, you and your wife and everyone else who cooks. You're doing a lot of chemistry. It's been known that different chemicals interact with silver. In fact, silver is a catalyst for all kinds of different transformations. I hope that you enjoyed the different colors that you saw there. Do you still have that spoon?
I don't know that we do. I guess after this was a couple months ago, and I kept it for a while, waiting for Larry to have a guest that I could call in.
Yeah.
But I don't know what happened to the spoon. We may or may not still have it.
The food writer Harold McGee has done experiments. He writes a column for the New York Times twice a month, and has written books about the science of cooking. He has done experiments with silver spoons. In fact, I'll tell you, John, when you go to my website, you know, we put a little summary after my visit with Larry here. I will put a reference on my website to Harold McGee's work on this, and maybe that'll shed some detailed light on what you're looking for.
Ah.
Hey, that's very, very nice of you. Thank you so much. And I always enjoy your Larry's program, but you're on, I really enjoy it much more even.
All right. Thank you, John. And by the way, your website is www.scifun.org. So it's S-C-I-F-U-N, scifun.org. And you post a lot on that website, and I was just mentioned there are so many cool experiments that you can run with your children. There are answers to a lot of questions that come up on this show and probably from elsewhere, I'm sure.
We enjoy doing this, Larry. I'm very blessed with very good staff who helped me do this. We list a summary of the conversation you and I have, and I include additional references, as I just mentioned, to John. But as the website also have experiments that people can download and do at home with their kids,
yeah,
with their friends. We aim to have kids of all ages enjoy the chemical transformations and to learn more about the beauty of science and to act responsibly in handling these chemicals. So all the experiments we have on the website are very safe to do at home and in the school. And we have other publications that deal with chemical experiments that can be done by teachers in the classroom and so on. But yes, please visit our website, communicate with us. I try to respond within 24 hours of getting a message from you, scifun.org, scifun.org.
Let's turn to Daryl in Exonia next. Let's see, get him on here. Hi, Daryl. Thank you for calling.
Oh.
Daryl, okay, are you there? I think his question had to do with atoms. How can we see atoms, I believe?
Fascinating question. They're not visible to the naked eye, but through instrumentation, we can detect them. We can learn more about their composition, their properties. So at the microscopic scale, even at the submicroscopic scale, they're visible via instrumentation. We're not able to see them directly, but we are able to learn about their behavior and their composition and how they are formed, how much energy it takes to break them up, how they disintegrate. So atoms have in them smaller particles, protons and neutrons, but they're in the nucleus of an atom, and the atom is surrounded by electrons. And the ratio of protons to neutrons, especially for the heavier elements, determines how stable they are, whether they undergo radioactive decay, radioactive disintegration. Mm-hmm. So that's a very good question, and I'll put a couple of references that you can quickly look at in the summary after this show.
Excuse me. Janine from Green Bay says, don't we all exhale carbon dioxide as the human population grows? How does that affect life on Earth?
Very good question, Janine. So air is a mixture. Mostly it's about 80% nitrogen and about 20% oxygen. So mm-hmm. I'm rounding off here.
Mm-hmm.
So we inhale about 20% oxygen, which is essential to life. And we exhale back about 16% of oxygen. So only a small fraction of what we inhale is absorbed by the body, but we also exhale carbon dioxide. And the carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere. It is converted via photosynthesis during the day in the sunlight by leaves into other chemicals. So, yes, the contribution from the human population from breathing is not significant. It's there. It's not mm-hmm. significant. It pales in comparison to the amount of carbon dioxide that humanity puts out via the combustion process, via the burning of fossil fuels. We use fossil fuels now. Since the Industrial Revolution, we have used fossil fuels for heating purposes, for transportation, all kinds of different purposes. Our automobiles run on the products of fossil material. And so that's the biggest source of increasing the amount of carbon dioxide that is in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is one of several greenhouse gases that we have to pay attention to, but by far it is the most important one to pay attention to. And so reducing our usage of material that involve burning carbon to produce carbon dioxide is something that is of great concern to all of us.
Kind of to go along with that, Pat in Port Washington emailed in and says, I know that hybrid or electric cars can reduce our carbon footprint versus a standard gasoline car. My question is, what's the environmental impact of mining the chemicals that make up the rechargeable battery in a hybrid or electric car? Also, how will these batteries be safely disposed of?
You know, Larry, these questions are – I'm just delighted to hear these questions because it shows that the listening audience is engaged in thinking through what it is that we do in our daily lives and how chemicals affect us. So, yes, the hybrid cars will reduce the carbon dioxide emission, but they're made of other chemicals, metals and other substances, and they have to be mined. And if those processes are not handled carefully – and safely, then they cause problems too. And this is a big discussion that goes on not only in this country, but especially in the developing countries. China, for example, I'm not trying to point the finger, just point out that mining in China, the regulations there are very different than they are here. And so the concerns that Pat is asking about are very real. And it takes responsible citizenry to be calling attention to such matters. So, yes, and then there's also the question that relates to the disposal of these materials. You know, what happens after something is used up, and how will it affect the environmental pollution concerns and so on? So very good question, Pat. And of course, the underlying point here is the economic point. You know, how viable economically are these processes, and how do they affect the materials that we then have to dispose of after we use them?
And I think in terms of batteries, at least what I've been told is that the batteries for hybrid cars are recycled up quite a large percentage of the total product of the battery itself is recycled and reused.
Yes, they are recycled. Of course, you know, the scale of usage now of hybrid cars is very small compared to the overall usage of automobiles. But these are important questions to think about as we try to transform our society and our dependence on fossil fuels into other sources of energy, looking into alternative sources of energy. So, yes, disposal, proper disposal is very important. The recycling is important. And I think it's very, very essential that all of us think about these points and try to act on them responsibly.
That email from Sherry from Stevens Point, who says her daughter turned off YouTube videos to watch your Christmas program. So thanks for being entertaining and informative.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed our Christmas program last December. I want to thank Wisconsin Public Television for airing it, and it's actually on PBS and cable stations around the country. And for people who want to get a copy of it, we have that available. If you go to our website and click on Christmas Lecture, it'll tell you how you can get a copy rather inexpensively.
We have a new, before we go back to the phones, we have a new Congress in Washington. We have a new governor and legislature in Wisconsin. This is going to have an effect on national science policies and on federal and state support for research and education.
Every time, Larry, there's a turnover in our elected officials, we have to be vigilant and pay attention to what our new leaders are saying and more importantly, what they're going to be doing. So I'm taking a wait-and-see attitude, although I must admit I'm not very comforted by what I hear. And I think we do have a difficult situation in the state of Wisconsin with a big deficit, $3 billion deficit. We have to pay attention to that. But on the federal level, we also have very, very serious concerns. I think there are going to be battles in the Congress, in the U.S. Congress, about the future of research, but that's only a part of looking at the overall picture for economic picture for the country. It is my sincere hope, and I would like to say that others share this, that in these battles, that the support for science, for education, for technology research continue to be at a healthy level. There are concerns immediately. There are immediate concerns about possibly keeping the funding levels flat, in real dollars, that could mean taking a cut. You know, we have to understand what these research funding funds are for, and they are not only to train future scientists, but they are to help us make new discoveries, to help us use the results of these discoveries to improve the quality of life in our local society, in our national society, and around the globe. It is very, very important to take a long-term view of what these research activities are for. I understand and I agree that we have serious fiscal problems, but we should be very thoughtful and very careful in terms of the budget allocations. And I ask everyone in the listening audience who cares about the quality of life in your locality and in America and around the globe to speak to your elected representatives about the importance of sustaining at an adequate level support for research in the sciences, support for education in the sciences, and support for innovations in technology. It's very, very important that we do that, especially with our newly elected leaders locally, at the state level, and in Washington. So please do that. And I think it behooves us to be responsible in that respect and to speak our voices strongly.
Wanted to go back to a caller earlier who had talked about phosphorus poisoning from fireworks. Someone else emailed in with a legal reference and says, except for tiny amounts in toy caps and party poppers, phosphorus has been banned from fireworks for a long time. Seems unlikely that this would have been a person would have gotten phosphorus poisoning from fireworks because it has been banned for quite some time.
Well, I didn't know. We didn't hear how this accident happened. We don't know any details. And so I stand by what I said in terms of consulting quietly, carefully, firmly with the medical staff. Yeah. And it's very important for all of us to understand what is happening to us and the consequences of accidents that happen. So that's my view on that.
Let's go to Lynette and Hubertus. Hi, Lynette.
Hi. I have what's probably a very elementary question.
Okay.
I wanted to take the chill out of some grapes that I had in the refrigerator, and I cut them in half, and I just wanted to microwave them for a couple of seconds just to take the chill out, and I was very surprised at what happened.
What happened?
They sparked and flamed, like, within a matter of 3 to 5 seconds.
What else did you have in the microwave oven?
I'm sorry?
What else was in the microwave oven? What did you put them in?
They were just on a plate.
Glass plate?
Just on a glass plate, yes.
You didn't put them on a piece of paper towel or anything like that. You had something metallic in there.
No, No, there was nothing that, no, it, but it did have a reaction like there was metal in there, but no. They sparked and flamed up as if there was metal, and then there was a smell that came from the grapes that they were burnt. Only 2 to 3, maybe 5 seconds tops.
I'll have to try that at home.
Well, I'd be careful about trying it at home after what you just said. I wanna consult with my colleague and coworker, Dr. Schreiner, about this because there are reports actually that I've heard about situations like this. But I can't give you a good answer right now, Lynette, except that don't do it again.
Well, you'll put something up on your website?
Yes, of course we will.
So check out Bassam's website at scifun.org, scifun.org. We'll see if we can come up with an answer. Maybe there's some metal in the grape or some element. Well, it would just rather than speculate, let's just go ahead and let you know, Lynn, that we'll put something up on Bassam's website. Ed in Wausau, let's go to you. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Sam, you were talking about carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Just this last weekend, there's a program coming out of Iowa University and an agriculture program, and they were talking about using tractors to plow up the soil versus a no-till method. And the conclusion they came to in the program was this: the nitrous oxide in the atmosphere lasts 4 times longer in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide, which kind of puts it into question as far as, carbon dioxide or nitrous oxide. You know, nitrous is much more harmful than carbon dioxide.
You're right, Ed, that there are properties of the different greenhouse gases that we have to be aware of, and that is some of these greenhouse gases, like the dinitrogen oxide and carbon dioxide, that not only the amounts that are present, but their lifetime in the atmosphere. Ed, do you know what the biggest greenhouse gas is?
Don't know.
Water vapor.
Wow.
Water vapor. And water vapor is a gas that, we can't control, that we know about the water cycle and so on. We can't control how much of that we put up. But the carbon dioxide gas has been identified as increasing more rapidly. The amount is increasing more rapidly in the atmosphere. And you're right. Nitrogen oxides and other greenhouse gases have a bigger effect on the warming of the planet, but it's a combination of looking at how much you have of any one particular gas, how long it stays there, and what its intrinsic properties are that cause the warming. So climate change is a very, very important part of what we now do research on and what we try to learn more about. And I'm going to also invite the listening audience, as they care to ask the real hard questions about climate change. And I know there is a little bit of controversy about it among some people. I'm for open conversation, open discussion. And as part of that discussion, we need to identify what the greenhouse gases are and what their effects are. So the last thing I want to say about this, Ed, unless you have something else to add, is that greenhouse gases are good for us. If it weren't for greenhouse gases, the surface of the planet would be the same temperature as Mars, and life as we know it would not exist here. So the question here is about the amount and identity of the greenhouse gases. That's what the question is.
And with that, we conclude. Bassam, thank you so much for being with us today. I look forward to your next visits, and congratulations on your appointment, president-elect.
Thank you so much, Larry.
Take a look at his website. It's www.scifun.org, S-C-I-F-U-N www.cleanhealth.org. Lots of great information on there. And he'll have a little summary and some additional materials that relate to today's program on that website. Won't be within the next hour, but it'll be as soon as they can in the next few days. Coming up, we're going to take a look at how you can achieve your maximum level of physical fitness. Dustin Maher, our personal trainer, with us next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.